This is podcast number 119 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm going to talk about the use of story as a learning tool. Today I want to share a chapter from a book called Some Great Stories and How to Tell Them by Richard Weick. When I first started learning about heart-based learning several years ago, I learned of a revival in the art of storytelling, especially among mothers and teachers of young children, that happened at the beginning of the 20th century. I searched out every book I could find on storytelling that was written at that time, which amounted to a couple of dozen, and studied every one of them. They're loaded with wisdom. We're going to talk more about it in a couple of months when we get to storytelling in the Mother's University. But for now, I thought it would be helpful to share a chapter from the book I just referenced, because he talks about his experience as a teacher using the stories of King Arthur in his classroom. This is heart-based learning in action. I'm going to talk more about King Arthur in the next podcast, but for today, notice how the story itself is the lesson. Especially make a note of the conclusion he makes at the end of the chapter. Once upon a time, the writer undertook to teach a little school in a far-off seacoast town in the south. The little village was on a sandy bluff overlooking the Sound and the sea. Cut off from the mainland by an impossible swamp in the rear, yet shut out from the great Atlantic by an ever-shifting sandbar that lay for leagues along the seacoast, it gave the little town an ideal harbor of shallow water, the home of fishermen and oystermen whose cottages were scattered for miles along the seacoast. Being isolated, the inhabitants were compelled to rely upon themselves, and in doing this had developed a solidarity of community life and a manhood and womanhood of purity and simplicity that was as refreshing as the breezes that ever swept its shores. Amid such surroundings, I began to teach, and it was one of my early experiences. Not having libraries or lectures to help me, I too must depend on self. I had never studied pedagogy and knew nothing of teaching except that which I had seen in the university lecture rooms. The teacher who preceded me heard lessons and the children said lessons. That seemed an easy proposition, for the questions were in the book and the children could memorize and say the answers. But I soon discovered that the children found no interest in the fact that one word was a verb and another a noun. They memorized the rules and repeated the lessons, but they were not at all interested in the subject. They were bored by this mechanical process, and so was the teacher. Something must be done. One day I told the class the story of Hiawatha's fishing. Every child listened with rapt attention. I had found something that they were interested in. I requested the children to write the story out for their lessons the next day. The majority of them did so, and read the story as they had understood and written it down. One little fellow said, "I ain't got no pencil," which meant that he didn't write it. "Tell it then," I said. He told it in such a vivid and realistic way that the class applauded. I had found something that the child liked. The second day I told the story of Hiawatha's fasting, then Hiawatha's friends, and so on, two stories a week until we had told the whole story of Hiawatha. But you ask, what did that have to do with grammar? From the story we got the nouns and verbs we studied, and the sentences that the advanced classes analyzed and studied. The whole school heard the story, it being an ungraded school with classes ranging from primary to high school. What else did we do with the story? Let us see. When the children told the story orally or on paper, it was creative work and better for expression than memorizing Mary Had a Little Lamb. The child received a mental picture. He heard the story, and retelling it in his own words, he created afresh the picture, thereby becoming a creator and an artist himself. In reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb, he was dealing with words. In telling the story, he was dealing with mental images. One day I saw the children playing out on the campus, and on making inquiries, they said, "We are playing Hiawatha and Mondamin and old Nokomis." They were dramatizing the story. It was taking effect. Had I been a trained teacher, I would have let them do it in class as part of their work. Twice a week, we got the words for our spelling lesson from the story. The children were so much interested in Hiawatha that they wanted to make pictures of Hiawatha. Then I let them illustrate the story, writing in their composition books the story and illustrating it. As we studied geography, the upper Mississippi Valley and the lake regions all took on new meaning because Hiawatha had once lived, toiled, and suffered there. But what had I done for those children most of all? I had fed their souls, given them a masterpiece of literature. Starting with the childhood of Hiawatha, we had followed him and admired him. We had roamed through that fairyland of dark green forest, heard the whispering pines, saw Hiawatha when he caught the king of fishers, slew the pearl feather, prayed and fasted for his people, punished Papakiwis, wooed and won Minnehaha, and when his task was done, sailed away into the fiery sunset. That something inexpressibly sweet and beautiful that I felt in the vision hour and longed to impart to the children and heretofore had not been able to, I had at last found incarnate in a hero, while the music, meter, and imagery of poetry had awakened the sense of the beautiful and revealed a new world to the children. New life had come into the school. It had been born again, and born from above. 2 months had passed. I had made an experiment. It had succeeded. Grammar, language, composition, spelling, drawing, storytelling had been taught by that method. Formal language had become linked to literature, and thereby to life. The formal had become an expression of the spiritual. Where could I find another such story? They all seemed tame in comparison to the sustained effort of a story like Hiawatha. I had discovered that the children could fully appreciate a great story told to them in a living, creative way, and that interest grew each day as we told the long story in sections to the end. The only other hero in literature that I knew in those first years of my experience in teaching was revealed in the story of King Arthur, which I had recently studied in a university. But were the ideals of the king suited to the children? That was the only source of the story available to me at that time, and it was more modern, more complicated in every way, and far more difficult to tell than the one we had just finished. After hearing a number of the Hiawatha stories, the children could and did read Longfellow's versions, but not so with the idyls of the king. While the children fully enjoyed the stories of the idyl, the style of Tennyson was not suited nor intended for children. All the imagery, heroic deeds, and idealism of Hiawatha were there, but in telling this story, much must be omitted. Involved plots must be made direct, and the story simplified. This required much more preparation on the part of the teacher, but we must have another story. It would not do to let the school fall back into the dead rut of lesson hearing, and though I feared they could not appreciate the Arthurian story, yet I would try. I began with the finding of a naked babe on the beach. The childhood of Arthur, Merlin's work, the sword Excalibur, and Arthur's coronation. At first, the children were not so much interested. Their minds were still on Hiawatha and his deeds. They were loath to leave him. But gradually, as I told of Arthur and his deeds, Gareth and Lynette, Geraint and Enid, Lancelot and Elaine, the quest of the Holy Grail, the flight of Guinevere, the passing of Arthur, the interest grew, and at times became intense, especially among the larger boys and girls. The story was coming home to them. King Arthur was a man like ourselves, of our own race. The whole story had brought the children face to face with a great ideal, Arthur, the blameless man. Pure himself, he demanded it in his knights and bound them by vows of obedience to their conscience and their king. He defended the weak against the wicked, broke up the robbers' dens and cleansed the land, led his knights in brave deeds, for it is said that when the fire of God filled him, none could stand against him in battle. He enjoyed the athletic sports and the tourneys, yet was so gentle they said his ways were sweet. As with Hiawatha, the story was reproduced, illustrated, correlated with English history and geography, and at the same time it furnished the most excellent material for ethical and aesthetic culture. After the last story was told, the passing of Arthur and the children saw, with Sir Bedivere, the king pass with the three tall queens in a barge over the sea. They stood in wonder, gazing on the splendor of his passing. Defeated in the last weird battle in the West, yet he was victorious in his ideals, for he became spiritual king of his race. From the great deep to the great deep he goes, the children heard, but did not quite understand. It was the better for that, because it awakened in the child something of the mystery of life and death. In that it served the highest purpose. It helped the child to realize that there are things in life that eye has not seen nor ear heard. Let it not be forgotten that while we use these great stories for formal work, the formal was always the result of the creative. The letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. Thus it was that children and teacher left the low plains of the lesson hearer, and hand in hand walked the upland pastures of the soul. This is not offered as a model method for teaching, but to reveal the source of the author's inspiration, the great interest of the children in the story, and a vision of its possibilities for education and culture led me to make a further study of the subject, which at that time received little attention by the schools. That was some years ago, and were I to teach again such a school, I would not and could not use exactly the same methods today. The underlying principle, however, that I stumbled on at that time is still true, but I should apply it differently. For one thing, I do not think I should teach technical grammar to children until they had reached the philosophic period. Then I would make it a pure science. I would give them much of the best story literature, both orally and in printed form, and perhaps I would speak of the grade as a story grade rather than a grammar grade, and say story school instead of grammar school. I would encourage and teach them to motive the story in all legitimate ways, such as dramatization, retelling, illustrating, singing, clay modeling in wood, metal, and in their daily intercourse with one another and in the world outside of the school. I hope that gave you some food for thought and inspiration for learning in your own home. Bye-bye. See you next time.